Welcome to the Interspecies Future podcast series. I'm your host, Bridie Addison Child. Interspecies Future is an initiative by Berlin-based Art Foundation, LAS, marking the beginning of a multi-decade civilizational journey in advancing the new rights and opportunities for non-human life on Earth, as made possible by the emergence of planetary-scale computing.
It's actually about creating this respect for them as part of this bigger, like, ecology or world that we live in.
We can actually, with these modern technologies, we can have the animals talk to us in a way that nobody else could do before. And we can do it across the planet.
A symposium in July will be the launch pad for interspecies work, gathering minds from the fields of biology, life science, computer science, animal rights, policy and creative practice to help define the interspecies discipline and set pathways for it to bend the evolution of AI towards nature. In this series, we will be joined by these leading thinkers, listening with them as they think through essential questions of our times.
And so they're looking back to say, okay, what did we miss out on when we stopped having Indigenous people be part of this conversation?
I think about Adrienne Marie Brown talking about the imagination battle and whose imagination are we living in?
That is one starting point, is to say when you're building these planetary computing platforms, you have to build them in a way that recognizes that Homo sapiens is just one of 8 million species on Earth.
These are other points of view and other forms of intelligence that have taken millions of years to evolve, that when taken with ours, expand the field of reality itself.
In this, episode one, we speak with two conveners and chairs of the symposium this July, Kenrick Aledo-McDowell and Jonathan Ledyard. This first conversation is hosted and moderated by Ayana Young from Of the Wild. We sat down to talk about how Interspecies Future has emerged and its urgency today.
Well, Kay and Jonathan, I would love if you could just take a moment and introduce yourselves in your own words.
Hi, I'm Kay Alato-McDowell. I am a writer and a technologist, and since about 2015, I've been working with AI and how it may be applied for artistic processes and practices. I have published a few books written with AI. One of them is Pharmaco-AI. Another that recently came out is called Amour Cringe, which is a romance novel. And I'm also the co-editor of a book called The Atlas of Anomalous AI. So my work has really focused on the theory and practice of art and design with and alongside AI.
Yeah, hi, I'm Jonathan Ledyard, originally from the Shetland Islands, which is like halfway between Scotland and Iceland. So I grew up really around nature and in this kind of primal state. And, you know, I'm a novelist and a technologist, a futurist. Previously, I used to be a foreign correspondent and a war correspondent. My first novel was appropriately called Giraffe, and the main characters in the novel are actually giraffes. And that was kind of interspecies novel before I knew what the interspecies was. And for the last several years, I've been focused on thinking through artificial intelligence and its approaches towards nature, which has led me to develop this idea of interspecies money.
Thank you both so much for starting us off that way and grounding us in this very large conversation. And I am wondering what an interspecies future could look like. So Jonathan, if you could start us off with this question, that would be wonderful.
I think we can't really define exactly what an interspecies future looks like just by the fact that we are just in this incredibly emergent space. I think maybe a starting point is to say that the interposition of technology, advanced technologies, is going to allow us to see, in some cases to comprehend, and perhaps at some point to provide services or assistance for non-human life forms on the planet in entirely new ways. Obviously, we could dig in on that a little bit more and talk about, you know, how artificial intelligence is going to evolve. And I've been a visiting professor in AI and nature in the last couple of years and have a kind of high-level view on where the architecture and evolution of artificial intelligence is going. It's a hyper-capitalistic field, which is optimized only for business returns, often business returns on venture capital funded projects. In that regard, nature and other species in particular find it even harder to make themselves known and remembered in that vast emergent space. So there is this really weird and terrifying prospect that we're 30 years down the road on a heated up planet, which is politically fractious and inequitous, and the non-human life forms which are sort of clinging on, you know, you might have a situation where you have very powerful artificial intelligence which simply has no memory or recognition of other life forms at all. That is one starting point for an interspecies future, is to say, when you're building these planetary computing platforms, you have to build them in a way that recognizes that Homo sapiens is just one of 8 million species on Earth.
I would add to what Jonathan's saying that there is something here about, you know, why make technology? I think this is a question that technologists really need to ask themselves, because when you get deep into the process of doing that and that becomes your career and where you spend a lot of your time, it's taken for granted that we need to make technology. And often, coming from a research point of view, often new capabilities are invented without necessarily an application in mind, which is, there's nothing wrong with that at all. But it begs the question of, well, what are we to do with this thing that we've created, you know? And I think this is where the visibility of the ecological crisis, you know, the visible cracks in the systems that we live in are actually very helpful in providing a purpose for technology. You know, if we were to think about technology in that way, along the lines of these crises, it seems like it clears up a lot of the existential questions that technologists might have of, why am I doing this? You know, of course, this is where you run up against the existing motivations for technology, you know, profit, expansion of dominion of certain actors. So, you know, personally find it very difficult to think of reasons to do things that don't involve healing or addressing these extinction and climate concerns. And to my mind, this is what an interspecies future really looks like or feels like to people, is that they become not just alienated individuals that are separate from life and from the ecosystem, but find ways of really seeing themselves in it. And the possibility that technologies like AI, like robotics and satellite sensing, can enable us to do that again, really inspires me to believe that they have a purpose, and that these are not things that we're making purely for their own sake, but they have a role of service to the larger life world that we're a part of.
Yeah, I would add that I think what we are trying to do with Interspecies Future is just have as open a dialogue as possible about this emergent space, to realize that it's something which, on the one hand, is very animist. It's harking back to our earliest days, where we obviously look to other species with far more curiosity than we presently do, but it's also kind of looking ahead and saying that we will have different relationships.
Yeah, I just see that so many parts of the human world reinforce a worldview that ignores interspeciality, whether that's from extractive economic structures to the ways we engage with popular media. And I'm wondering, especially considering the interdisciplinary work you're doing with the conference and your backgrounds in art, ethics, and AI, how we engage with interspecies realities in new and hopeful ways. And maybe, Kenrick, if you want to take that.
I think it's important to acknowledge that we already are engaging in an interspecies relation, and we live in an interspecies context. So what we're proposing to do, what many people are proposing to do, and we're hoping to organize with the symposium and this work, is an acknowledgement of the already existing interspecies context that we live in. In a way, it's a bringing back into awareness of what has been left out and forgotten in our technology making and our world making, in, you know, expanding into other disciplines, like, you know, the role that the imagination and art have to play in this. I think moving beyond the imaginaries that we have, moving beyond the subjecthood definitions that we have, this is something that art is always doing, is proposing alternative selfhoods for us and alternative ways of seeing and hearing and feeling. And in terms of my experience with AI, we're in a moment where AI is growing very rapidly, and we're determining how we will be using it, what our interfaces to it will be, and who will be using it. So I think it's a very important moment for us to look at our design methodologies and our ways of thinking about interaction, interaction design, user experience, and even the underlying data sets and structures that inform our AI, and realizing that we have reproduced a human-centric worldview in this. We clearly need to bring non-humans into our design thinking. And so part of the way that we're thinking about interdisciplinarity is not so much in terms of what exactly it is that people study, but how what they study can be applied to building capabilities that are necessary to sense and relate to non-humans through technological means. In doing that, what we're hoping will emerge are spontaneous connections between people that can help communities connect and or form communities of researchers. We're hoping that by gathering and convening this group of people, you know, to create a sort of emergent network that is highly motivated to address specific concerns, specific capabilities, specific problems.
What was coming up for me, Kay, while you were speaking was this phrase, all hands on deck, or we need everyone at the table. And I really appreciate the interdisciplinary or this kind of expansive approach, because I think it's really easy for us to get stuck in our fields or our echo chambers. But right now, I think breaking that and really seeing across boundaries and trusting each other, which can be hard at times, especially right now, but we're up against so much. So to be in a space that is bringing together these unlikely partnerships, it brings up these feelings of the unknown. Like, what could happen? What can happen when we bring together these unlikely partnerships to think beyond the blocks that we're in at this moment? So it's exciting, and I definitely am feeling this beginner's mind of coming in without an agenda or really knowing what can come of it, but knowing that something will.
Yeah, and that's why I think the one thing with the interspecies future, which is absolutely critical, is to, in this incredibly juvenile, stupid tachistocracy that we have at the moment of division and sniping and cancellation on all sides, we just want this very gentle, very big tent where everybody can come to the party and contribute. And I think that will be the success or failure of this, you know, movement.
One thing I can maybe add to that I've observed in working with artists and technologists together is that oftentimes when you bring disciplines together, there's a sort of period of calibration where people need to learn each other's languages and learn each other's vocabulary and find where even the same words can mean different things to different people. And this seems like a critical beginning, sort of like not knowing. This seems like an important place to begin is in establishing vocabulary and learning to listen to other ways of describing things and other ways of sensing and understanding non-humans, but even more broadly, you know, interdisciplinarity, learning new language. This is kind of the overarching project as well, right? To be able to cross boundaries of species as well. So if we can't do that with our structures of knowledge, then it's going to be very difficult to do it with our very, you know, structures of our experience of the world, you know, with humans and non-humans.
Yeah, this notion of crossing the species divide, I think, and crossing both ways, so human to non-human, but also non-human to human, and eventually, as we say, at some future point, the machine in the middle may be providing translation. I'm incredibly buoyant and excited and optimistic that we're at the cusp of a really regenerative moment. We always should be a little bit radical and try and make space for the other species in the conversation. I think it's such a difficult thing to talk about because I'm pretty sure that it's beyond our present imagination what in the 22nd century people will think about other species and even how other species will regard us. I do think that our children and grandchildren will understand more about many species than we presently do, and as a result of that, be more sympathetic and protective of them. But that's what's super exciting, I think. You know, it's really about expanding the compass of our curiosity, the compass of our understanding, and obviously our moral compass as well.
Jonathan was talking about how we don't know what the future of interspecies relations will be, and had also mentioned at one point the importance of this as an intergenerational project. And so it's something I think is a key to reiterate, is that in thinking at the scale of ecology and in thinking at the scale of species preservation, one does have to think intergenerationally. And so much of this project is designed with that in mind. And to me, one thing that's important in it is loyalty or allegiance to the people to come and seeing ourselves as ancestors and trying to address and direct our work toward a future is a form of allegiance to future generations.
I guess there's this question in me of how do we stay grounded and well in this work of imagining futures and wielding power with technology, because it is powerful, as we've seen. And so I am questioning this fine line of having the confidence to create and to imagine a world that is healthier and healing, and also balancing that out with our humanity, knowing that we're in these cultures that have been, that are broken in so many ways. And so, yeah, there's just this question around how we do this work with enough passion to make it happen, but with enough humility to know that we are still just humans trying our best.
I think, Ayana, you said humility is key, and I think it's absolutely this weird space at the moment where you are simultaneously being incredibly audacious and arrogant to try and put yourself into a position of speaking on behalf of a non-human life form. I don't really understand what your needs are, but I'm going to try and put us on a path, a trajectory, where we actually build systems which are curious about that. I had this weird experience last month when I was in South Sudan. And in South Sudan, there's really big flooding at the moment. The Nile has burst its banks, and there's about a million people who have been displaced and who are starving. And I was going through this ecosystem there, which was 1 meter underwater, was with an entomologist, and we were talking about termites. So the termites account for 50% of the biomass in that ecosystem. And they're all dead. They're all drowned. Every single termite mound was drowned. So we were in a boat, and we were just passing the tops of these termite mounds. And you've probably seen that they have these kind of funnels or chimneys, which the termites make. And the water had spilled down the throat of these tunnels. And some of these termite mounds had taken 20, 30 years to be built by these termites. And I just had this thought that maybe in an interspecies future, there would be some communion with those termites. At least we would think about them in a more persuasive way, and then we would represent them in the world in some more sophisticated way.
Thinking back, Jonathan, to something that you've written extensively about, which is the concept of interspecies money. Quote, the biggest threat to diverse biological life on Earth is the failure of the market economy to correctly price natural capital. And yeah, I think just taking a moment with that, it's a huge statement, but I think it's something that we all really need to look at deeply, because that's, you know, we live under a capitalistic regime and we need to deal with that. And I'm wondering if you could offer some explanation of the concept and suggest some ways that it may help us to see beyond the human.
Interspecies money is a really basic technology interface of this interspecies future, which holds that for some species, in some situations, it's possible to give them a stable digital identity. So if we took a giraffe, for example, you could give that giraffe an individual identity. If the giraffe has that identity, it spins up a digital twin, and the twin can hold some financial value. And then you can write some simple rules about what the giraffe might like to happen. Maybe the giraffe will pay to be observed. Maybe the giraffe will pay for more space. Maybe it will pay not to get shot, so there's some security. And we could talk about this, you know, for a long time.
Okay.
But there is one interesting point, you know, where there's a very strong monetary theory which holds that money is just a form of human memory. We don't value non-human life in the wild, whether that's a termite mound, whether that's a bat colony, whether it's a charismatic mammal. Because we don't value it in any explicit way in our economy, we have no memory of it correctly in our economy. So, you know, we've lost half of our wild animals on Earth since 1970. We've lost between 20 and 40% of pollinating insects in tropics in the last 30 years. And unless we work out a new economic system, non-human life will be obliterated, and not through malice, but simply because the human population is going to double again You know, if we look at a country like Uganda, next door to here in Kenya, 53% of the population is under the age of 18, and they're going to have children. They also living in one of the most biodiverse ecosystems on Earth. So if we want the poorest communities on the planet to cohabit with the richest range of life forms on the planet, then we have to be pragmatic about it. And I think that interspecies money has legitimate criticism, which can and will be leveled against it. But unless we reward those communities for seeing other life forms, for dwelling on them, and for giving them space to continue to exist, then the reality is that they won't exist, and we'll get to 2050 or 2060, and we will have lost, you know, 60-70% of the biodiversity in tropical parts of the planet. But there is this other point, just to build out on the artificial intelligence side, which is that if we want our future machine intelligence to be aware of other life forms, we have to also create a financial mechanism which allows for the perpetual acquisition of data or the perpetual seeing of those other life forms. And in that sense, interspecies money is providing this other role of training up future machine intelligence to be in a position to be a helpful guardian for life on Earth beyond the human.
Jonathan, when you were reflecting in your last response about just the species extinction rates and what kind of planet we are moving into, there's definitely a fear factor that comes up with that. And of course, I think there are so many possibilities to change. And I think humanity is deeply capable of adaptation and growth. But at the same time, we don't have all the time in the world to change. And I'd just love to hear both of your thoughts on how we can ground futurist movements in both a need to act urgently, but also wisely and in a way that helps us process the deep losses that we are already experiencing on a daily basis.
I think it's really important in answering this question. I think it's really important that we consider who participates in futurist movements. This is, I think, one of the main ways that we can begin to free ourselves from the historical limitations of futurism. So thinking about the future from an indigenous perspective, from an African perspective, you know, being in conversation with people that can represent those perspectives, I think this is a critical piece in understanding even what the future is. You know, part of futurism can be very dissociative in the sense that it looks forward from the present and extrapolates on certain things that are happening in the present without necessarily looking to the past or without recognizing the traumas that are playing out in the present, individually and collectively. So I think we need a redefinition of what futurism is and who participates in it and what it's for. And that can begin to ground it more and allow it to be less dissociative and less escapist. Because, you know, even in literature, science fiction and fantasy and futurism are all kind of intertwined. And not that there's anything wrong with fantasy, it's a really important faculty. But the urgency of the situation that we're facing requires that we not continue perpetuating certain tropes or ways of avoiding the suffering in the present in how we construct futures. And so, you know, acknowledging that we are always constructing futures, and especially in technology, really looking beyond the worldviews that have constructed this particular version of futurism is a really critical foundational layer to all of this. And when it comes to, you know, projecting futures and imagining futures in a situation that is filled with, you know, loss and suffering and grief. We have to be able to be present with the things that are happening and not dissociate from those currently either, whether those, you know, that not just futures that we might dissociate from, but the things that are actively driving our imaginations now. So art, again, is the place that our culture allows the expression of these things. So by having artists present and envisioning ways that art can allow us to be fully embodied in our imagination of the future by giving us access to areas of feeling that are repressed by a dissociative form of futurism.
I think we don't want to dissociate, like what you're saying, in this fantastical worldview, but at the same time, we know we need that imagination. And I think about Adrienne Marie Brown talking about the imagination battle and whose imagination are we living in? Because some people think that they can imagine drilling a mile-long tunnel to mine rare earth minerals under a glacier. And some people are trying to imagine just trying to grow food for their community. And so we do need to stretch our imaginations in this time and really consent to whose imagination we're believing in, because mm-hmm. these worldviews dictate how we move through the world and what our culture is made of. So I think just what you were saying really hits on so many important points, and I appreciate that. And I feel like we could have an entire episode just on those few topics. But as we conclude, I wanted to meditate for a moment on a quote of yours, Kay, from the chapter AI Ethics in your book, Pharmaco-AI, where you write, quote, "The objective is not to create a new culture of human transcendence. It is to live in symbiosis with machines. And through this, to live in the expression of the universe in its own image, which is semiosis, or the creation of meaning. This is not a conflict, but a revelation," end quote. So I just want to give you both the floor. Maybe Kay, you could start with and just close us out with that quote as an inspiration.
Well, I mean, first of all, the book is written with AI, but it's the subject matter it addresses is ecology, and very often through the idea of Umwelt, which is the inner life world of a being, of an animal. And this, to me, is a key to understanding the richness of the biodiversity that's threatened, is understanding that these are other points of view and other forms of intelligence that have taken millions of years to evolve and are not, you know, simply assets or capitalizable materials, but are living points of view on reality that, when taken with ours, expand the field of reality itself. I mean, this is something I learned in writing that book, was that this idea of semiosis, this making of meaning through sensing, whether it's machine sensing, human sensing, or non-human sensing, is a literal expansion of the experienced field of reality. So the loss of, you know, species and life forms on Earth, and animals and plants, but also the loss of other forms of intelligence that are yet to be experienced is a loss to reality itself. So this is, you know, what motivates me to participate in both of these fields of AI and in the application of AI towards ecology, is that this is fundamentally an expansion of reality, and that to me seems like maybe why the universe exists.
I completely second what Cameron just said. I think I would probably just end by really striking a really positive note, that obviously we're living in this extraordinarily difficult time where we're going to be called upon to really express imagination and empathy, which we have not yet expressed as a species. But I really think that we are on the cusp of some truly exciting moment. And I do think if we land one point today about interspecies future, is that everybody is welcome it's an exploration. You asked us to define an interspecies future, and I think that might even be a multi-generational journey. So I'll probably just leave it at that.
This podcast is produced on the occasion of the Interspecies Future Symposium in July 2022, co-hosted by Light Art Space and the Museum für Naturkunde in Berlin. The symposium has been orchestrated and convened by the chairs, Kenrick Aledo McDowell and Jonathan Ledyard, with Bettina Kamez and Johannes Vogel. The wider programme has been curated by Light Art Space Head of Programmes Amira Gad, with Corinne Meinat as co-organiser of the Interspecies Future Symposium and surrounding activities. This series is produced and hosted by me, Bridie Addison-Child. It is a reduced listening production supported by Light Art Space.